Hello, this is Yarrow, and welcome to Vested Capital, episode number 22, featuring my guest, Russ Heddleston, the co-founder and CEO of DocSend, which was acquired in March of 2021 by Dropbox for $165 million. Vested Capital is a podcast about how people make money and put their capital to work. I interview startup founders, angel investors, venture capitalists, crypto and stock traders, real estate investors, and leaders in technology. Today, you're in for a treat with my interview with Russ Heddleston as he shares the story behind the creation of DocSend, a company that allows you to securely share and get analytics about documents you send across the internet. So we hear about the origin story behind that idea, what they did to initially grow it, the focus on product development as a marketing technique, some really unique insights into a content marketing strategy that's a bit counterintuitive at first, but make sure you listen to the whole story because I think it's very relevant for anyone who's running marketing. I certainly took it as the chief of marketing for my own company. I was thinking, that might be an opportunity for me to kind of replicate this idea that Russ and his team used to grow DocSend. And then we hear the completion of the story. Well, maybe it's completion of the start of his story because DocSend is still an ongoing unit now within Dropbox. But we do hear about that acquisition. So how DocSend was eventually sold to Dropbox for $165 million. Of course, we also go back in time and hear the first origin story of Russ and his prior company before starting DocSend, which is a company called Pursuit, which was acquired by Facebook. When I say acquired, though, it was more of an acqui-hire. So they were acquiring the company to get the talent, including Russ, behind the company. There's some really interesting insights, in fact, as to why his first company, which was called Pursuit, didn't become, you know, a rocket ship, didn't really work in the traditional sense of a startup, even though they were acquired. Very counterintuitive to why it didn't work. And that led to some interesting insights, which Russ carried forward with his co-founders when they started DocSend, around this idea of doing research into why your company might not work or why it hasn't been done already in the way you're thinking about doing it. That was definitely counterintuitive for me to think about. So really good lesson from Pursuit, which they carried forward into DocSend. Great startup story here. Really great technical founder. So lots of insights from Russ on growing a SaaS company. He especially loves business-to-business SaaS, as you'll hear in the end of the interview. And speaking of the end of the interview, we also talked about what he's done with some of his winnings. Obviously, he was a co-founder, so had a large chunk of that $165 million went to him. He didn't give us too many details, but it was interesting to hear what his philosophy is around how he uses some of that money investing, you know, being an angel investor as well, or a limited partner in some funds and so on. So you'll love this if you're interested in starting your own SaaS. And on that note, if you do want to share this interview with anyone who is starting their own SaaS startup, this is definitely one of those episodes to share. Lots of insights into the marketing side, the growing of the team side, and the getting investment side. That's pretty much the focus of this interview. And also, if you have not done so already, please do subscribe to Vested Capital. Why haven't you subscribed right now? We're at 22 episodes, so you should be a subscriber. Hit the plus, the follow, or the subscribe button on the app you're currently using to listen to this podcast. It could be Google or Spotify or Amazon or Apple with iTunes. They're all great places to get Vested Capital. Download it. That way you'll get every episode as I release it. Plus, you can go back through the entire back catalog or pick and choose which ones you like and have a listen to them. Also, share this episode and share Vested Capital with anyone who's interested in growing their capital or interested in startups or property investing or crypto. I've got lots of interesting guests coming up in all those topics, property, crypto, more startup founders stories to share coming up on a future episode very soon. But for now, we're going to dive into this interview with Russ Heddleston, the co-founder of DocSend. Here we go. Russ, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Darrell. Great to be on.
So, I mean, if anyone Googles your name, they're going to find out that you are the co-founder and CEO of Dropbox and also the story of being acquired by DocSend. I'd love to dive into the startup story of DocSend and leading to the acquisition, but I always start my podcast by going back in time and just finding a little bit about your early days. So, where were you born and raised?
Yeah, sure. So, I was actually born in San Francisco, but my dad was in the military. So, I moved around a fair amount to like San Francisco to Berlin to Denver, Colorado. And then I did middle school and high school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. and then moved out to California to go to undergrad and grad at Stanford. And that's kind of where I got into tech, and I've been loving it ever since.
So you did like computer science in Stanford, I assume?
I started off actually not knowing what I wanted to study and decided to study engineering. So I started in electrical engineering and built robots, and then ended up liking the software side of it more. So I did a master's in computer science. But yeah, so yeah, it's kind of worked on a few different things, but left Stanford being very, very smitten with just software, the internet, and you know, building technology companies.
So was the plan while you were in Stanford? I know that's a unique situation where it's not uncommon to be thinking entrepreneurial as your next step, even while you're in Stanford, as opposed to maybe other universities where it's more, I'm going to get a job in a career, you know, lawyer, doctor, whatever. Were you thinking I'm going to be an entrepreneur upon graduation, or what was your thought process?
I wasn't sure. It wasn't like a thing I had to do. I did a fellowship program called the Mayfield Fellows Program at Stanford. It's a 9-month work study program that was just really, really excellent. And I learned a ton about entrepreneurship and met some really great people. Leaving Stanford, I didn't think about starting a company, but I did, you know, interviewed a bunch of places and decided to join a very early stage company that just raised a Series A, where one of my mentors was the lead investor for the Series A called Graystripe. So I joined when there were like 6 or 7 people there. And that kind of started my full-time entrepreneurial journey. Although I did, you know, intern at different startups while I was at Stanford as well, just kind of getting a feel for it and meeting fun people. And it's just a really exciting atmosphere to startups in general, where it's new, it's risky, you know, trying to make a world a better place, like interesting ideas. And you have a lot of agency and control over what you work on. And you have a very quick turnaround to like see impact of your work. And those are always things that I've really enjoyed.
Nice. Yeah. So did that initial startup, you were an early employee. So did you ride that all the way to it leaving, or did you leave earlier and start your own thing?
I left to go to business school at Harvard. So I was at Graystripe for about 3 years, and it is not uncommon at startups. You know, I moved around a few different times there, ended up running the engineering team. And then you're kind of rebuilding the company, pivoted over to the early iPhone and advertising on it. And that worked out well. So after I left, they ended up selling the business to ValueClick. And it was a good outcome for everyone involved.
Okay. So you chose an MBA as your next step.
I did. It was funny. In the interview I had there, they were basically like, why do you want to go to business school? And my response was like, well, yeah, I think there is a big opportunity cost. And as an engineer, I don't need to, but I just thought it'd be a lot of fun. And I thought that the curriculum would be useful and the network would be useful. And so, you know, those things have definitely turned out to be true for me. So whenever people are like, oh, should I go back and get an MBA? I'm like, well, the answer is it depends. Most people don't need to, especially if you're already in tech. Mm. But you know, I thought it was a really great experience for me, but mainly because that's had a lot of interest in that. And just kind of, it's an overview of things I, you know, didn't know anything about. And it was also a great place to start my first business, was to go try starting a company while I was in an MBA program.
Is that what you did?
Yeah, I interned at Dropbox for my summer while I was out of Harvard, and there were 15 people there at the time. It was very, very small. I tracked down Drew and said, hey, I'm going to do some great work for you this summer if you'd let me. And it did. You know. But then after that, started my own company called Pursuit with a couple engineers that I'd worked with at Trulia. And we raised a seed round money for that and kind of like built and launched our first product. And that company didn't make it, mainly because we chose not to keep going because the stats just didn't look like we wanted them to with the product that we launched. And we were going to pivot and ended up selling to Facebook as a talent acquisition, interviewed at LinkedIn and Facebook. And so anyway, yeah, that Pursuit was something I got off the ground while I was in business school.
Yeah, just tell me a little bit more about Pursuit. I know it was like a referral network for sourcing talent. Was that the sort of summary, like you were trying to monetize the process of hiring and sourcing good employees? Is that roughly it?
Yeah, pretty much. As they say, there are no new ideas in the world. So other people have tried that as well. I think it's probably better as a feature of the, you know, like a talent or something, or the ATS, the applicant tracking system. But yeah, the idea was that referrals are a really great source of high quality candidates. But if we can motivate people to share those opportunities in their network further, then you'll get even better quality candidates being referred. And so we were hoping to use the kind of referral bonus that companies often use as an incentive and split that amongst multiple people. So, you know, it was a reasonable idea at the time.
Yeah. I mean, when you say it, it sounds like it makes complete sense. But I think I remember hearing another podcast, you talked a little bit about the counterintuitive reason why that didn't actually work out. You mind just sharing, you know, what that was?
Yeah. And this is a good example of something for all founders, you know, like, you know, when you go start something like for Pursuit, we were solving a problem that we ourselves had as engineers and trying to source good talent. And so we just got right in and started building. And the reasons that it didn't work were probably reasons we could have been able to understand before we even started writing code, which was that the people who are the best at referring other candidates generally do it for reasons other than money. So as soon as you involve money, it gets weird for them. So with our system, what ended up happening is that, yeah, we were referring candidates, but they were referring them outside of the system. So the money, rather than acting as a motivator to share these things, actually detracted from the people who were best able to like get these things referred out there. So the behavioral psychology of what we built just didn't fit super well. And for my master's at Stanford, I studied human-computer interaction. And I picked that one just because I think that there is a lot of nuance to like how we as humans interact with websites, software, the internet, other humans, and behavioral psychology is like just super relevant. So, you know, that was a great learning experience with Pursuit, going through the whole process end to end. But it definitely has informed my thinking on when I talk to other founders, like, what's all the research you can do ahead of time? And like, how far down the line can you think about what you're building and the implications to it? And if it's actually going to work and solve a need, or if there are going to be unintended consequences to the way in which you set up incentives in the software you're building, in whatever type of software that is.
Yeah, I can imagine it'd be difficult to discover that while you're building the platform. I can imagine you could certainly do some exploratory research without the software, but you know, I wouldn't necessarily jump to that conclusion. I mean, I'm even thinking back to my own experience right now with my current co-founder. We're talking about, like, we have an affiliate program that refers a commission, but then we have natural word of mouth. And there's something about offering the money to stimulate word of mouth kind of diminishes the natural aspect of the word of mouth. So it is interesting psychology. I'm curious, with your complete from beginning to end process with Pursuit and then working at Facebook, what did you take away from that experience in terms of what you would do differently with your next ultimate startup, which I believe, you know, was DocSend?
Yeah, I mean, one of the takeaways was, you know, most things don't work. And so if it's not going to work, you want to get to know quickly. So I'm happy that we didn't keep working on Pursuit. I don't think it would have worked out at the end of the day. I'm very happy that we decided to go to Facebook, got to work on amazing stuff there, meet some really, really talented people, have a ton of impact. And then when I left and started DocSend, I've got two founders, Dave and Tony. We all went to undergrad at Stanford together. We all worked at Graystripe together. Before we started writing code, we actually interviewed a bunch of potential users and just did a lot of research in the market on this concept that was DocSend and why might it be a bad idea. And you know, if something is a bad idea, hopefully with a couple months of research, you can figure out why, talk to other people who've tried to do that in the past or who's failed at it, or just generally do as much research as you can. But if it's a good idea, you basically can't prove it's a good idea. You just kind of fail to prove it's a bad idea. So for DocSend, we spent a few months before we started writing code being like, why on earth hasn't anyone else done this? Because a lot of the value props and features in DocSend already existed in other systems. And there was, you know, a list of companies that have tried and failed something similar. And then we also went around to big companies and said, why don't you build this internally? And so kind of at the end of it, we were like, well, someone should build this. Like, it makes sense if you're sending documents that it's better to be a link than an attachment. And it makes sense that you as the sender would like to see if they're reading it and for how long, and do they forward it to anybody? Those things all make sense. So someone, so at a certain point where they're like, wait, we just got to go build it. One of the interesting behavioral psychology parts of DocSend early on was that there was a common concern that, hey, by tracking people's usage, maybe that is creepy. And maybe that's like a bad thing. And so maybe you're going to fail because like people don't like being tracked. And throughout the whole history of DocSend, that has continued to come up. But what we found early on was that it's a pretty small minority of people who push back on it like that. For a lot of the scenarios in which DocSend is used, like you as the sender and then between you and the recipient, you know, that's really important information that's being shared. And so just as if you and I were having like, you know, a conversation like this, I can tell if you're paying attention, I can tell your body language, I can see that you're giving me your attention, which is awesome. And if I send you a DocSend link and you read it, you could either view that as, hey, that's kind of creepy, I'm tracking you, or I as the sender end up just being very appreciative. Like, thank you, Yaro, for spending 3.5 minutes reading my pitch deck that I've poured a lot of time into. And so there are enough people for whom like this adds value that DocSend's been able to take off. And so it ended up not being a concern and it has not impacted any of our growth numbers. But it's interesting to me that it was such a big potential concern early on. And a lot of people pointed to it as like a reason that DocSend might fail. But and we're well over 20,000 customers now, growing really, really fast. And it has continued to be the case that DocSend just adds a lot of value. And that is not a concern.
Yeah, I'm thinking back. I listened to your interview with Jason Calcanis on This Week in Startups, and you guys certainly had a bit of a back and forth about the different pros and cons around that sense of the security around both just sending an email and the acknowledgement of receiving it and opening it. And then, of course, the same thing with DocSend, receiving a document, opening it. What slide did you read in a presentation for a pitch, for example? And I could see both sides of the fence there where certain people, even just for the sake who like to argue about privacy, will just say, that's dangerous. But then for all the reasons you just said, there's benefit too. It just enhances the relationship, keeps the flow of communication going better. And then, of course, you don't really know until you put it out into the world and see what kind of backlash, if there is any at all, that you get. So I'd love to, though, just even take a quick step back. What was the initial thought process around this idea? Because clearly you researched it a lot, but was there a moment in time where you guys were like, we need this, let's build it?
Certainly, for me personally, it would have been helpful when I was fundraising for Pursuit, sending around my pitch deck there. But interning at Dropbox, I really like Dropbox early on because it got rid of the need for me to email myself attachments. that was a thing people had to do, 15 years ago. And so, Dropbox solved that. You could have all your files synced effortlessly between your devices. Like, that's fantastic. And so it got rid of the need for attachments there. And the summer I was there, they came out with the link sharing model, or the schmodel, where I could send you a link to a file, or I could invite you to like be an owner of that file or folder. And so like, cool, you'll never have to email attachments again. But people just still sent so many attachments. And so we talked to salespeople, we talked to people in finance, financial services, quite a few different roles where those people were sending information in the form of a document to someone external at some other company, and they were using attachment. So we were asking people like, why are you sending it as an attachment? If there are all sorts of problems where, I'm sending you a PowerPoint file, you might not have PowerPoint, I send you a Keynote, you might not have Keynote. Like, maybe the fonts aren't embedded and you don't have the fonts in your computer. It's like, so, the state of the art is like, okay, I'm gonna send you a giant PDF attachment. And what we realized is that all those use cases are kind of the same, what people are doing there, and that we just had to add enough value to the sender and make it easy enough for the recipient that we would change people's behavior. And so that was a whole bunch of little incremental things, but that ended up being the insight that we got from all those early interviews. And there were a lot of competitors at the time. There's still a lot of competitors today. Our thought process was like, why don't we just be the best at it? Like, the best way to like send a link to a file and see what happens to it and have control over that file. There's another benefit too, which is that if someone's sending this important information feels that it's more secure, they're more likely to share more. As opposed to, hey, I need to be in person and give you like a lookbook that I take away at the end of it. So by creating a more trusting environment, you actually incent sharing more. So, like DocSend, we've tried to keep it really simple, really intuitive. And then we've over time built it to cater to more and more complicated workflows around external file sending. So yeah, people like the product. It tends to spread itself. Organic, inbound, word of mouth is still our number one channel. So a lot of those things that we figured out early on continue to be true.
As a result of just researching yourself, Russ, I researched DocSend a lot more than I had in the past. I'd certainly heard of it, but I didn't sort of connect the dots to my use case. Right now, my company, it's called Inbox.io, and we basically provide executive assistants that specialize in email management. And we have a lot of clients that are like doctors, lawyers, venture capital, angel investors, and they're still sending a lot of attachments. As you can imagine, often with very either personal financial information or medical information. And we realize the exposure we have with our assistants just potentially sending the attachment to the wrong place or something like that. So we're like, we're actually instigating DocSend across our company now as a required client service that we're just going to bundle with what we do for them just for that, protection for ourselves as well. And it's funny, we didn't think of it beforehand. So it's taken doing this podcast that made us go, we really need this.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, we do talk about DocSend as a horizontal technology we have to market vertically because, we thought about going really deep on like one particular vertical, but the workflows are kind of all the same. So if you go to our website, you'll see our marketing is targeted to certain use cases like fundraising, for example. Like fundraising is something I had to do for DocSend. It's something I care a lot about. It's really interesting. And, you know, DocSend is an awesome fit for that. So we do a lot of marketing tailored to fundraising, and I've gotten to be really well educated about it as a result. And because DocSend is used there, we have so much data that we can use to publish research on it. But DocSend as a product, super horizontal. So yeah, I get that a lot where people are like, oh, I had this need and I didn't even think about it. But then it turns out like DocSend is great for that. And for me, I'm like, yeah, it's that is exactly what we built, a horizontal technology that is useful across a variety of situations. And oftentimes people kind of stumble into it and then they're like, ah, it's perfect for me. And I'm like, great.
I'd love to just talk a little about that startup phase. So I know you said you've got about 20,000 clients, right, customers right now. Right in that first, you built the MVP version of the software, you were ready to actually have customers use it. Could you talk about that phase and just, I don't know, the first 100, first 200, first 500 customers? Like, what was that initial growth strategy?
Sure. Yeah. So like, we didn't have a great growth strategy when we started DocSend. We launched it at TechCrunch Disrupt and we just put up kind of a marketing site that said document analytics. Now it's kind of it. And it was free. You didn't have to pay for it. And we thought maybe it'll just take off like crazy. It'll be viral. It'll be like, you know, Hotmail or something. And it wasn't, but it also wasn't zero. So like it was kind of growing linearly. And then we thought, oh, okay, maybe this is going to be great for sales teams. So we went and sold that up market into like big sales teams. And we still have a lot of like enterprise customers for DocSend. And you know, that's what they use DocSend for. And it's great for that. But we kind of arrived at what it looks like today just by talking to more customers. So the first thing I do is like hang your shingle out, you know, put up your sign that says, hey, here's what we've got, you know, lemonade stand. You got to put up the stand first. And then we just paid attention to like, hey, who's coming by? Who's the most engaged with it? Who likes it the most? What are they using it for? And like that kind of ongoing discovery process helped us make the product better, helped us represent the value that the product brings more accurately on our marketing site. And so those things just kind of like steadily built on top of each other. And so if you zoom out, it looks like a pretty perfect hockey stick, even though a lot of it was just very incremental along the way. So there, I think, has to be some faith at the beginning that like, hey, if this ends up being a useful service, it's going to have some very specific properties. And one of those properties for DocSend is that the product generates awareness for itself. Mm-hmm. So if we can capitalize on that, it ends up becoming exponential. So it didn't take off exponentially at first, but it's always been better than linear. And by just being patient and by like making the product better and better and better, it's just continued to perform really well, which has been awesome to see. So we always joked that we were going to be an overnight success after a decade, and it only took 8 years.
Ahead of schedule. Nice. Yeah, the inbuilt virality of sending a document with a link that says DocSend that then gives you the experience of using it. It does harken back to the old Hotmail days when you send a Hotmail with Hotmail from Hotmail, and then you'd want to know what that is. So
yeah. The only unintuitive thing there is that it's not as common that the recipients are also senders. So, you know, for example, in the startup fundraising use case, venture capital investors actually don't send that many documents. Like they're receiving a lot of documents. Mm-hmm. They do eventually send their own documents when they go through their own fundraise, but they only go through their own fundraise typically every like 2, 3, 4 years. So it's much less common. But what we found was that a lot of those investors end up being advocates for DocSend for their own investments because they would get links and they might grumble a little bit about it. And then they click on them anyway because it's just faster than like responding back like, hey, send me the attachment, which is just like, I got the link. Fine, I'll click on it or look at it. But then other founders, they're like, hey, you should use DocSend when you send around your deck for your fundraise that I'm a part of. And so ended up being word of mouth more so than product virality. Although there is still some product virality, whereas Hotmail or like a superhuman, anyone who's sending email or receiving email is also doing the inverse, right? You receive an email, you're also sending emails. And so anyway, every product category is different. That's just part of the nuance to DocSend.
Yeah, yeah. That's another nuance. It's a little bit like the nuance you had with Pursuit, the same thing. You don't necessarily see it until you start practicing. I'm, as a startup founder, and a lot of the listeners are the same, we face this decision about how to put our marketing budget to work. And, you know, you've got pay-per-click on whatever it was, Google, Facebook, Instagram, and so on. PR, you sponsored TechCrunch Disrupt. That would have been an investment of some money. Not after the, you know, word of mouth viral part, before you got to that phase, how did you guys navigate that decision-making process, you know, where to put money and test a new marketing technique?
We've never really had a great marketing engine. I think kind of a paid acquisition marketing engine can make sense if you're doing vertical SaaS. So if we had stayed 100% focused on the sales enablement one, throwing conferences, and then you know, you're like a Gainsight trying to define a category type of thing, or like Salesforce. And so you can end up putting a lot of dollars to work via traditional marketing means. For DocSend, we did early on experiment with different marketing budgets, but none of that really moved the needle. So we just put all of our money and time into just making the product better. And then I think a lot about message market fit is something that's independent from product market fit. So for DocSend marketing, basically figuring out what is the right messaging for our product and who is using it, and then how do we describe the way they're using it in words that they're going to understand. And so for DocSend, typically we're like a new product that people are using. Just like you were saying, Garo, your team is sending out attachments. And so we're replacing attachments. That's pretty common. So people aren't searching a lot for it, which is problematic. So it's hard to throw a bunch of dollars at like Instagram marketing or something, and people aren't really in market right there. And so, it is kind of tricky. Like, how do you get into someone's consideration set? How do you even convince someone they have a problem? And so a lot of that is just making our product better and better and better. The thing that did work well for us on marketing and continues to has been data-driven research and content marketing. So one property of DocSend is like, hey, if people are sending out their pitch decks as DocSend links, like we can see all that in aggregate. And we're very security oriented. So anyone who's part of our research opts into being part of our research. But then we'd go through and like analyze those pitch decks, like look at all their stats, people take surveys. And so this actually gave us really interesting takeaways for if you're raising a pre-seed round or a seed round, or if you're an investor raising a round of capital, like where do your LPs come from? What do people care about? What's in those decks? Where do people spend their time? What correlates to success? What correlates to failure? And it also was something I wanted, because back when I was starting Pursuit or even with DocSend, I get all this advice from people, but I'm like, it's all anecdotal advice. Does anyone have anything that's slightly more scientific? And so those research reports are awesome for DocSend. Even if people never end up using our product, they're just great pieces of content that educate, inform, kind of make specific to the fundraising marketplace, just make it more efficient on both sides by educating founders and kind of educating everyone on like what are best practices. And so that's a marketing playbook we can also repeat by vertical. You know, as we get into like sales enablement content or investor relations, or pick your use case, if there are documents being sent there, there's some best practices DocSend could probably surface and help give advice to people around.
That's interesting. So it's like you're not pitching your actual software, but you're doing research on the users of the software, producing content that sources data that's very relevant to the target market. They're not looking for DocSend, but they find that research relevant and maybe get circulated through, news sites and so on, or just Google search. Then they read it. Then they realize it's all kind of powered by DocSend. That's where the data came from. They're aware of the service, and then they discover it and then potentially start using it.
Yeah, it's a little bit very circular. Intuitive, but I've often found that like the most obvious channels are the ones that are already kind of overinvested in. So it's like, DocSend is a great e-signature product, but the keywords for that are very, very expensive. So, it's like, how can you profitably acquire customers through those channels? Or, hey, we're going to go like sponsor big events and stuff like that. Like those things have a really long ROI, if they have any ROI.
Yeah.
Whereas the content marketing, it is expensive to produce and time consuming. However, it's an evergreen asset. So when people share it around, it's like, we just need people to be aware of what is DocSend. And then the rest kind of takes care of itself from there because of how much time we've spent investing in the product experience itself. And so that's just one way to like, especially we only raised $15 million for DocSend, and we're able to compete with really, really big companies to create mindshare and to create like a large user base. So I think from a marketing perspective for any startup or product, it's just good to ask yourself, well, what are the potentially unintuitive superpowers that this product has? And then how do we use the product to like gain more awareness for ourselves in the ways that are other than just like, let's just throw money at Google search. And we do those things too for DocSend, but it's more like 10, 15, 20% of our net new signups should come from paid rather than, we've just got like a giant demand gen engine that's accounting for most of our growth.
Okay. That leads me to another question then. So given product as marketing was clearly a focus for you guys, you were relying on just producing the best version of this solution. That, correct me if I'm wrong, would have meant a lot of your funding went into talent on the engineering side and, product development side. What did that look like for you guys? Because I know you came from a background of having, I don't know if you're computer science, I'm not sure how much of a developer you were yourself. So what was like the initial engineering team around DocSend?
Yeah, great question. So my co-founders, Dave and Tony, are also software engineers. So when we were starting out, yeah, we all just sat around coding. It was great. We would just be at a different person's apartment every day, kind of rotate around, and you know, we'd sit down and just write code together. It was great. And at a certain point, you know, we're like, okay, we got to go talk to some potential customers. Then we got to go do fundraising. So I went off and did the fundraising and raised a seed round of $1.7 million from Uncork. And yeah, that money all went to like hiring more engineers to work on the product. So I think having a good engineering culture is something you've got to start early, and it helps if the founders are engineers, because the founders are able to create the engineering environment that other great talent wants to be a part of. And that's always something we've prioritized. And at a certain point in DocSend's history, you know, our growth was happening fast enough that we were just profitable. And in that situation, we actually didn't want to grow our engineering team too quickly. It's just really hard to maintain culture if you are growing at a crazy rate. And some companies have to, but we tried to grow engineering about 50% year over year, just so we had time to onboard people, to really invest in them, so everyone understood their swim lanes. And so there are just multiple philosophies on how you can build a great engineering organization. I do think it is important for any company's engineering organization to be motivated, to be focused, because that ends up showing up in the product. You know, like we've never really had any downtime for DocSend. And everything we've built has made sense. And that's because behind it are people who enjoy their jobs and are motivated and, you know, have a pretty tight-knit culture. And especially if you're a company that's relying on product-led growth, that's really, really important. So I give a lot of credit to my co-founders, Tony and Dave, for just how they've built great teams over the years and like created such a great engineering culture for DocSend. And, you know, you can always just pay more for people, and we have to be very competitive in compensation, but that's only part of the story, right? Like it's really important to have a manager that respects you, for you to feel like your work is impactful. And that really shows up just in the interviews. And a lot of like the people who work on DocSend like came through referrals. It goes back to like the pursuit thing where it's like referrals are awesome, but they only work if it's a place that people really want to work at.
So just to connect the dots with the financing as well, you said earlier about $15 million you raised in total before you were acquired by Dropbox. And it sounds like you were the point man for raising funds, being, you know, the CEO and front facing for that. Was that relatively easy to raise? Because it sounds like you guys became profitable pretty quickly. Or was it challenging to raise because you were basically building software initially? Maybe the first seed round was the hardest because you didn't maybe have the users yet, and you were trying to go out there and say, we're going to lead with product. We don't know how well it's going to do. Give us your money. Is that kind of how it went? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think for the seed round was definitely the hardest round to raise. I think it was helpful that you have three engineers who were building this together. I think it's helpful that Dave, Tony, and I have all worked together before. Going back to like leaving Stanford, you know, I didn't start my own thing. I went and worked at someone else's company and met some great people, spent a lot more time with Dave and Tony, built relationships. And so, you know, it also helped that I'd already, you know, sold a company to Facebook. So when we went out to fundraise for DocSend, the message was basically like, hey, great founding team, we are going to be able to build this thing. We've done a lot of research and think that it's something worth building. And here's kind of like the evidence we have that says like, hey, this could be something big. And we got a lot of no's. A lot of people are like, oh, we want to see more traction, or I got to see more revenue, or hey, there's no defensible moat here, or why wouldn't Microsoft do this, or like those sorts of things. But you only need one yes, which is nice. So my goal for fundraising for DocSend for the seed round was like, hey, let me go talk to a whole bunch of really smart people in 2 weeks and see if we can get a round raised. And if we can't, we'll just go back to building. And so having that confidence was really helpful going into the process. And so yeah, Jeff at Uncork said, hey, I'll lead the round. I said, awesome, great. And then, so that was the seed round. The Series A was from Howard at August Capital. And he looked at the seed round for us, but they had a $500 million fund, which is just too big of a fund to bother with the seed round. You know, they got to put much more money than that to work. And they led our Series A just because Howard started getting DocSend links from other founders. So even before we started charging for the product, you know, he'd been following us and he was like, hey, I think you guys can build it. And, you know, I think you're going to figure it out. So we raised the $8 million Series A, which is really fortunate, right? But it speaks to keeping in touch and delivering on what you say you're going to do. So when I checked in with Howard, it's like, hey, yeah, we're building it. We're doing exactly what we said we're going to do. It's working. And here's what we're doing next. And at a certain point, you know, we had the confidence to say like, okay, yeah, we'll do your Series A. So we'd raised $10 million at that point. And I think for every company, typically there comes a point in time where you need to create a business out of it. So, you know, by the time we got to Series B metrics, we didn't need a whole lot of money. And so we only raised $5 million from DCM. And that round was also one where Kyle Louie joined the board and he and I knew each other from business school. So again, that's something of benefit from business school. And he just was really intrigued with what we were doing and really liked the product-led growth and thought it could compound into something pretty interesting. And so the question was, you know, how much money do you need? So we had another offer for a lot more money. And I said, well, I don't think we need a ton of money right now. Like, money is not our bottleneck, but a little bit more would help. So we only raised $5 million. And it just helped us like have confidence in 2018, 2019, really to go through and like redo our marketing messaging. So we revamped a lot of like our pricing, our packaging, our positioning for DocSend, which then actually really started to fuel the flywheel. And then by the time we could have raised a much larger round, we realized that, well, money is not our bottleneck anymore because we're profitable and it's actually growing quickly. Access to more users is the bottleneck. And so that's ultimately why we decided to sell to Dropbox, because they just have all the users that, you know, we would want to go eventually acquire. So
yeah. And obviously want to talk about that in a second. I can really see the almost like a beachhead market you guys had with the pitch decks, and that naturally gets you in front of, well, obviously the users being the companies raising, but then their end user was the investor. The investor sees they're using DocSend. What's this company? And then it kind of reinforces for raising funds. I don't know if that was deliberate, but that certainly sounds like an advantage. Would you mind just telling me a little about, you said like the repositioning and the pricing started to, you know, add a bit of fuel to the fire. Like, what was the change there?
Yeah. So what had happened was, remember, we started with document analytics. That's what it said on the website. And then we said, hey, we're able to sell this thing to like big sales teams. Let's just do that. So we changed the messaging on the website to be sales enablement. And all we talked about was just the sales use case for it. But people kept signing up for all sorts of things. Like, our support team would get these questions like, are you the service that does blah, blah, blah? And then we'd be like, yeah. And then they just go off and pay us. And then we like tried to gate things behind this like enterprise wall, like talk to the sales. And a lot of people were like, no, I get it. Your product makes sense. I don't need to talk to sales. Just where do I put my credit card in?
Right.
So beginning 2018, I just, you know, as I mentioned earlier, was just chatting with lots of users and like looking at interesting use cases and being like, what are they doing with our product? And after having enough conversations, you know, we decided like, I don't think that sales enablement is the right messaging on our website. Like, yeah, sales teams should use DocSend or something like DocSend. That makes a ton of sense. But what we're doing is much broader than that. And we were not charging enough. I didn't realize. Like, I remember talking to one investment banker and the managing director, and you know, he's like, I love your service. I send documents to my secretary. I send the links. Then she sends me screenshots of people reading my documents. I'm like, oh, cool. He's like, it's crazy. We just don't pay you for your service. And I was like, well, your secretary pays us $10 a month. And he's like I said, we just don't pay you for your service. So when we redid our pricing, we increased pricing by a lot. So we took everything out from behind like the enterprise paywall. We made everything self-serve, and we came out with what is now the advanced plan, which costs $150 a month and 3 seats are included. That's a lot more expensive than $10 a month, right? But conversion went up, because what people started using DocSend for as we expanded the product was as a data room. So if we're competing with Intralinks, which is charging $15,000, $20,000 for it, and you're looking to buy a data room provider, if DocSend's only charging $10 a month, like, that cannot be the same category of software. That's just insane. That doesn't make any sense. It becomes much more important that you buy the right software than you save a little bit of money here or there. So by increasing pricing up to $150 a month, so it's $1,800 for a year, you know, that's at least in the right ballpark. You know, and then in order to do that, we had to change up all the messaging on our websites. And so if you, the little 4 P's thing, you know, we left the product the same, but we changed pricing, packaging, and positioning. Mm-hmm. And getting into data rooms is like $2.5 billion a year in revenue, is a huge market for us. Like, we're able to be quite successful there. We also have gotten into e-signatures. And so as we continue to add more and more functionality to DocSend, it increases the LTV, it increases engagement, it increases virality, all that sorts of stuff. But it was so interesting for me a few years ago, like going through, and that's why I said message market fit is so important. So for DocSend, kind of figuring out that right messaging on the website allowed us to take advantage of the product spreading awareness for itself and reduced a ton of user confusion. Like, really smart, creative users were able to figure out how to use DocSend for different things. But for everyone else, like, we had to make it obvious for them, right? Like, if you go to a product's website and it doesn't speak to you and your use case for it, you're not going to go buy it and figure out if you can shoehorn it into your use case, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Like the product has to say like, hey, I know who you are and here's exactly how you're going to use our product. And so by doing that, that just increased conversion a ton.
And was that mostly driven by your research into your current customer base, right? Like you weren't guessing, you knew by seeing segments within your customers, okay, they're using it for this. We haven't really presented our positioning and our marketing materials around that. Let's do that. Is that right?
It's like the intrepid few we'd find, you know, there's like the people who were using it for something and we're just like, isn't that interesting? You know, a few of them would chat with us and answer our questions and be like, why are you using it for this? Yeah. So they were already in our user base, but by having a relatively cheap product, that meant that it was pretty accessible. It wasn't like, you know, $50,000 minimum annual spend, which is just a different way to go about things. So by having DocSend as a product be something that you have a free trial with it, we used to have freemium for it as well. We were just able to like observe how it's being used and then unblock people there, which is actually a super valuable lesson from Facebook early on too. I remember Chris Cox talking about how they would just observe Facebook users running into walls and then unblock those things for them. Like when Facebook came out with the news feed, it's because people were just running around all their friends' profiles to see if anything was new, which is insane. Just put that in a news feed, you know, and for DocSend, it was like, okay, wow, people are really wanting to send one link to multiple documents. We should probably build that feature. Oh, now we're a data room provider. Okay, cool. What does that mean? And kind of like following the thread incrementally along.
Yeah, that must be fun too as a founder. I know we're almost getting close to the last sort of 10 minutes here, Russ. I'd love to know, obviously, the decision to exit. So a bit of a loop here. You were interning at Dropbox. So you clearly, and that was early days at Dropbox too. I think you said only 5 employees at the time. Was that when you were interning?
15 or 20.
15?
Yeah.
Okay. So you clearly were in touch with everyone on staff then. So you would have known the founding team very well. How much did that play into the decision to ultimately partner and sell DocSend to Dropbox?
I don't think very much of my personal relationship mattered. Like, okay. I mean, so Drew's founder and the CEO of Dropbox, and it certainly didn't hurt that I worked with him in the past. So I think that there is some amount of trust there that was useful, but we just created a great business. And so certainly Dropbox was inspirational to us as we created DocSend, you know, product-led growth, just make the product really intuitive, like just make it work. So there's a lot of overlap there in terms of like approach to building products that Dropbox certainly liked. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was one where we didn't really shop it around. There was one other interested buyer. And then it ended up being more of like a personal decision that, you know, we were excited to work with Dropbox, like this kind of fit into their vision of the future. And for us, it was exciting to think about having access to their really, really large user base. So it is kind of a rare and interesting, you know, full journey to come, you know, back to Dropbox years later. It's funny because when they turned on my Dropbox account, like I still had all my old work stuff in there, you know, from 10 years ago. Like, yeah. Oh, it's still here. But it just happened to be the case that what we built with DocSend fit in really well to what Dropbox was moving towards in the future. And, you know, big companies evolve too. So, you know, I kept in touch with Dropbox and some other potential strategics, and we didn't need to sell DocSend. It's just something that we did because it was exciting and interesting and a good fit.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, it sold for, correct me if I'm wrong, it's TechCrunch I'm quoting for here, $165 million. How did you determine a price, whatever you're comfortable sharing in terms of numbers? I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on like the situation and the scenario. Sometimes founders use like a term sheet to drive up the price, sometimes just willingness to pay. But for DocSend, we hadn't raised a whole lot of money. So that meant that everyone could make money. And that what they reported is at like 11x ARR. So it's like, it could have been a lot more. Sure. Could have been a lot less. Sure. In our situation, there's just a big middle zone. So there's just some negotiating, but I'm sure it's different in every single scenario. But for us, it seemed like a reasonable exit at the time. I think any deal that happens, probably both sides feel like it should have been more in their favor. But, you know, for DocBox, keeping our eye on the prize is like, yeah, this is an exciting combination between the two companies. And it was great for our investors. It's great for our employees. And it's great for DocSend's customers as we get to continue to build out and evolve the product and just continue to make it more and more useful for them. So everyone won, which is one of the situations that doesn't happen all that often. So for me, my co-founders, you know, yeah, we're excited about it. And we're going to be working on DocSend and helping Dropbox for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I think it's very clear that you're very much committed to the continuing journey of DocSend. You weren't like looking to exit and then, you know, leave completely. But I am curious, obviously, big proportion of that $165 million hit your bank or your equity in shares, whatever, I'm not sure what it was, whatever the case may be, is a lot of money. Did it change your thinking even around investing and what to do? Like, did you suddenly think, now I'm going to angel invest a lot? You're more conservative. My podcast is called Vested Capital. So we're always interested in when you get a big capital infusion, what do you actually decide to do with it?
Yeah, I mean, I've been investing for years before because, you know, I was at Facebook early as well. And, you know, my bar typically for investing is like, do I like the founder enough that I would help them anyway? And if I'm going to help them anyway, and there's an opportunity, then I definitely will put money in too. So that's fun. And I just like being a part of different software companies. So that's a lot of fun. Having access to more capital now, you know, sure, I've become an LP in a few different venture funds. You know, but it hasn't really changed the day-to-day stuff. And for me, I always remember that I think building software is just really interesting and fun. And there's just so much value to add in the world, like creating great software. So, I mean, that's what I'll continue to do and be involved in. And there's lots to do left with DocSend, but it didn't like fundamentally change this, like how okay. You know, my day-to-day or how I think about it. Because it's like, great, this is an awesome financial win for everybody. Do I need to go invest a ton in other companies for some reason? Like, no, I don't. But I do like getting involved and in helping where I can. And having money does help with that in terms of like the size of impact I can have. Yeah. So I'm sure that's something I'll continue to do.
Anything else? Cryptocurrency, EFTs? Obviously, you know, you have to park money somewhere. Just always curious to hear, well, you know, did you buy a nice car? You know, everyone loves hearing those stories. Maybe it was back with Facebook when that was your first sort of experience of an exit like that.
Well, my wife and I are usually not very showy people, you know, so okay. we've been pretty conservative on those fronts. And then in terms of like where to park money for like the best return, it's always such a crapshoot, you know, in terms of what the future will hold. It's the old business school adage, like past performance doesn't indicate future success type of things. So for me, I tend to stick to being pretty conservative with what we do with our own, you know, personal capital. And then if we're going to make an investment in something, it just has to make sense to me. So, you know, there's plenty going on in the crypto NFT worlds that, you know, I kind of scratch my head and I'm like, that would have been a great investment a few years ago, but it's not entirely clear to me exactly what it's useful for or how I would use it. So I tend to stay away from things that apparently make sense to other people, but like don't connect with me as well. I'm happy to miss out on like some big wins just to stick with stuff that I'm interested in and for sure understand. So like B2B software, B2B SaaS software, that's a great category. Man, there are a lot of boring, profitable companies to be created and scaled in just B2B SaaS software. And having been through this a couple of times now, I really enjoy talking to first-time founders or companies that are earlier because we've just learned so many lessons over the years working on this stuff. And I love to pass that knowledge on. But those are the areas where I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Someone should have built this years ago and you're doing it and you're going to market and people are paying you for your software. And I'm sure this will work out great. So, you know, those are the ones where I get the most excited about the boring, obvious ones.
Fair enough. So software guy through and through. Russ, any other sort of last words of wisdom you want to pass on to people? I mean, I am kind of curious now what your kind of vision is for the future, because you are working not just in your own company, but now it's a bigger, you know, you're in a larger company with multiple missions, not just your own. But is your focus just on getting as many users to Dropbox?
I mean, it's both, right? Like when you join a larger organization, it's you want to make the, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 or 5 or 10. And so for now, yeah, we're just focused on DocSend, continue to improve it, but then doing that in the context of Dropbox. So there's just so much integrating that has to happen, whether it's support or sales or go to market or the product, just getting all these systems to work together. And then, you know, as Dropbox evolves its own like strategy, you know, just being part of that and influencing it. So, you know, those are really fun things to be part of. That's my main source of like time these days is working on that stuff. And it's been a lot of fun so far.
Okay, nice. So where can people find you if they want to get in touch?
Sure. Just on LinkedIn or on Twitter, or even just Russ@DocSend or Russ@Dropbox.com. All those things work.
Awesome. Russ, thank you for taking the time to share the story. I love hearing the origin as well as, you know, the nuts and bolts of growing DocSend and a few really insightful, almost psychological things more than just pure software development or marketing issues that you shared here. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you, Yara. It's great talking to you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with DocSend's co-founder, Russ Hedelston. I really appreciated him sharing the details behind the growth and eventual acquisition of DocSend. And it was just a fun interview. So I hope you felt the same. You heard me mention several times during this interview, my own company, inboxdone.com, and in fact, how we're looking at rolling out DocSend as part of our service. So what we do is we provide virtual executive assistants who specialize in superior communication, and they take over replying to your email. They take over managing your calendar. They take over your social media direct messages. They can reply to those. And they're basically fantastic with the written word and having that attention to detail to know how to manage something as personal and as private as those inboxes. And we're looking to use DocSend as a tool to help secure the information that is shared by our clients. So basically, our assistants that we assign to clients will be using DocSend to provide that extra layer of security. And it's definitely something we see as a valuable addition to the service we offer. And that's why I'm talking about it. It's the sponsor of today's episode of the Vested Capital podcast. That's my company, inboxdone.com. So if you want to simplify your life, if you want to break free from living in your inbox, and you're looking for an executive assistant service that really specializes in replying and managing to email, as well as all the other tasks that are associated with email, calendar scheduling, forwarding invoices, entering data into other software tools, doing basic research, but mostly just getting into that inbox, replying to your messages so you can not spend all day in there and gain back 1, 2, 3, maybe even 4 hours a day and a lot of mental freedom as well. We are currently taking on new clients as we wrap up 2021. So we do have some space to onboard you in the months ahead. You can always get in touch with us by going to inboxdone.com and booking a discovery call where you can tell us what things you need to delegate to us. We'd love to hear from you. That's inboxdone.com. Okay, that's it for me. I'm going to get this interview out to you now. So I hope you enjoyed it, and I look forward to talking to you on the very next episode. Bye-bye.